I think that they feel like people that work in tech make more money and that they'll spend money. And so they were just trying to attract high salary, high skilled people there and thinking that the city would benefit from that. And then I think a secondary benefit of that has just been that they've gotten a lot of press and they've looked very cool that they've had this thought. And so again, bravo to the person that did that.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I'm super stoked to announce and introduce our guest, Erin Spradlin. Erin, thanks so much for being on the show.
Yes, thank you so much, Suja. We have already had kind of a nice pre-chat, and I am looking forward to like our official chat.
Definitely. Yeah, Erin's got a lot to share and can't wait to dive into it. So everyone, Erin co-owns Erin and James Real Estate, which services the Denver and Colorado Springs markets. She has recently completed a book about how remote workers are impacting real estate and how to make them your tenant base. The book's name is American Nomads and is available on Amazon. Awesome. So Erin, we're excited to dive into the book. Why don't you start us off with telling us how you got started in real estate and why?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I had kind of been brought into it through Airbnb, which is to say I had a 9-to-5 job in marketing, but my husband and I, he was my boyfriend at the time. When we met, we weren't ready to live together. So I just said, let's put my place up on Airbnb. If I get $400 a month, I'll be ecstatic and it will help justify us both paying rent. And it just turned out that within half an hour, we were making tons of money. And then I was like, let's move in together because we're making so much money. So then we started to do more Airbnbs. And then with that, we also thought, well, other people might want a real estate agent that could speak specifically to Airbnb laws and help set them up through the whole process, but also allow them to do a legal Airbnb because the laws are written city by city. So we really specialized in that and we quit our jobs within a month of each other. It was pretty wild and it was sink or swim at that point. And it was the best decision I have ever made. It was wonderful. So we became real estate agents at that time, but then we also started to acquire investments and they were single family homes or condos. And I know a lot of people have mixed feelings about condos, but we were doing that and then doing Airbnb or a modified blend of that, depending on what the law was.
Okay. Awesome. So I want to dive more into the Airbnb business because it's clearly one of your expertises. I'm curious, what did you guys do before you got into that Airbnb business? Like, what were your full-time jobs?
Yeah, so I was a marketing director and I had worked at a number of small marketing firms that also worked with small businesses. So I think for that, I felt confidence to go into business for myself because I'd had a lot of exposure to that. I will also say that for my last three jobs, I was not very happy with the job. And I thought, I'm the only common denominator here, so I really can't blame anyone but myself. But something has to change. And so that was part of it. And I had always just wanted to own my own business. And my husband worked for the PR department for the Colorado Supreme Court. And he was actually working in a department that helped put out information to keep lawyers out of getting in trouble. So very random. But basically, we were both in PR and marketing when we made the leap.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, I definitely can relate to the story of just not being happy in any job. I definitely was not happy in any job, no matter how good the company was. And ultimately, I just had to accept that I was, you know, meant to do something on my own and not really fulfill someone else's vision and dream. So yes, you know, I think a lot of people, this is going to be a hard question to answer potentially, but when I get asked Airbnb questions, because, you know, I have a background and a business in Airbnb as well, and, you know, short-term rental operating. When you say you guys started to make like tons of money all at once, like within half an hour, can you put some numbers or just give us some context about that? I mean, you had said you would be ecstatic if you made $400 a month.
Yeah. And so this was actually, so I think we formalized the business in 2007. That's when the laws had kind of changed. But in 2014 is when I put my place up. So this is, even though that doesn't seem that long ago, it is really, it was much earlier days for Airbnb. So there wasn't a lot of competition. And so I just mean within half an hour, I had a $100 booking for that night. And then basically I had a booking every single night of the month for $100, you know, with very little effort. So we're looking at making $3,000 on a place where my rent is $1,200, you know? And so it was like, huh. And I'm not trying, right? Like, I know if I specialize or if I do something different, I could probably even hire numbers. And so that's what it looked like. And then we had acquired, you know, then we were doing what they call Airbnb arbitrage, where you rent out other places and then do Airbnb on them. And again, much harder to get away with these days. But back then, when they didn't necessarily know what was going on, you know, we had two or three of those. So we were making, you know, between $1,500 and $3,000 per property per month on that. And so it was like, oh my, you know, I'd never seen money like that. So it was exciting.
Yeah, totally. I love hearing that story and can definitely relate. The way I got into Airbnb was my basement tenant moved out and I was basically just delaying finding another tenant. And I was like, well, I'll just throw it up on Airbnb. I put like literally an air mattress down there and all of the random furniture and comforters and sheets and linens that I had, none of which matched or looked good at all together. And threw it on Airbnb. And I was immediately making three times as much as I would have with a long-term renter down in my basement. And, you know, for example, it was like $60 a night. And I'm pretty sure it would have gone for more, but I was making, you know, 600 plus utilities on a long-term renter. And so just immediately making three times as much, it was like kind of mind-blowing. It was 2016. So similarly, you know, not as much competition as there was later on. Okay. So, you know, obviously for those of you who aren't as familiar with Airbnb, there's been a lot of local regulations that have made it more difficult to rent out entire spaces, like entire houses or entire apartments. And maybe it's probably somewhat different in Colorado because every jurisdiction is different. But one of your specialties, Erin, is helping people determine, you know, how to invest in Airbnb properties and work with local regulations and what those good markets are. Can you talk about some about that? I'm sure people are curious.
Yeah. So early days, my husband, I think, likes education a lot. And so we wanted to get up and teach and talk to people about the experience and that it was feasible. And so make it more accessible to them. I am less prone to talk to a group of people. I'm much more comfortable in a one-on-one situation like this and whatnot. And so, but I wanted to add value to the company. So I just ended up calling every single city to see what the laws were. And it kind of breaks down three ways. It's like a city either has a law prohibiting 30 days. So it's written in the code. So they have a law prohibiting 30-day or less rentals. They have no law. So it's a free-for-all, or they've written something in adopting it. And so we just started calling all these cities to see who was Airbnb friendly, who was not, who was actually following compliance versus not. And so we just really wrote a lot of SEO around that and, you know, definitely brought this into the classes. And so I think that's how we started to have that specialty. And then also I think, you know, I had never been in a sales capacity before. I'd been in marketing, but not in sales. And I know I felt like a little bit intimidated to go into real estate and stuff because I didn't want to be a salesy person. I'm not like that. But then when they talk about the fact that, you know, if you sell something you really believe in, it's not very hard to do. And I felt strongly about that. Like Airbnb had changed my life so much that it wasn't very hard for me to be super enthusiastic about it and want to talk to people about it. And so it was an easier transition for me than I expected it to be.
For sure. Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure you can't get into so many of these details, but would you give us like maybe just some hints as to like Airbnb friendly cities that you found? Or you don't have to if you don't want to.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I think that when you're looking at major metros, I mean, you can always call the planning department and ask them and they'll tell you. In Denver, I will say Denver is not very friendly. It has to be your primary residence. And that is true for Boulder and Aurora as well. Colorado Springs and Manitou Springs have sort of a caveat, but it's much harder to find those properties because they're very competitive. I will say one that's local that is a great place for it and has an Airbnb friendly law is Littleton, Colorado, and that's between Colorado Springs and Denver. And that's a great city because they have, you know, an Airbnb friendly law. They have a very cute downtown. They have light rail that goes through it. And then it is between Colorado Springs and Denver. So you could live there, you know, depending on what you wanted to do, you could have a pure rental. If you eventually wanted to move into it, you would have access to all these other great cities. But also just the pure rental side of it is the best part because you don't need to worry about an unhappy neighbor ending your rental. And I do see a lot of people too that even if they live in cities that are Airbnb favorable, they do it for 3 or 4 years and then they get tired of it because although it's great money, it's not easy money. You're definitely working and then they transition out of it or they sell it. And it's very attractive again to be in a city where you can sell that kind of an investment.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Well, thanks for those tidbits of information. Really helpful for anyone getting into Airbnb. So that kind of dovetails with your book that you're working on, right? And can you talk about how Airbnb and your book intersect and tell us about, you know, this book that you're launching?
Sure. Thank you for asking. I'm always excited to talk about this. It's about to be on Amazon. It's probably going to be on Amazon by the time this posts. The way I'm thinking about this book or the way that this book came about is that when COVID hit, I felt like it would really push remote work. I felt like remote work was one of those things that employees had wanted for a long time, but reluctant employers didn't want to do. And so I was very interested early days about what that would look like and, you know, the power that employees would have at that point. And so when it first started, I began to track all the Google alerts and trends around remote workers because I just personally had an interest in it because I really believe in it. But then I wasn't even necessarily thinking about the real estate side. And then, you know, we got 6 months, 8 months into it. And I heard actually an NPR article in October of 2020. And they were saying that up to 24 million Americans were going to move if they were no longer tethered to their jobs. And I was like, stop the press. Like, I'm not going to take any more clients. I'm going to write a book about this because it's absolutely going to change like where people want to live and what they can do. And I personally hypothesized that I felt that people would want to move into cities and live there for a month or two and then try out the next city or, you know, especially because again, they're not grounded to a job and they're not grounded to a location. So I was really interested in that trend. And then I think at the same time, you know, I would say within 2 to 3 months of NPR posting that article, then I was starting to see that Airbnb was putting stuff on their website. And they were also working with, so Airbnb had put something up called Try Before You Buy. And that is kind of based at people that, again, are trying out different cities, deciding where they want to live. So it's the 30 plus day, but furnished model. And so I felt like Airbnb was really on top of this trend as well. And you were seeing it with Zillow as well. But then a third leg of this is that there was something called Tulsa Remote, and Tulsa Remote was something that launched 2 or 3 years ago, and it was meant to get tech workers to come to Tulsa. And so they would pay tech workers all this money, and they just needed to stay for a year or more. And Tulsa Remote had fantastic success. I mean, like 95% or more stayed for longer than a year. It really juiced the economy. You had to make $100,000 or more to live there. So when Tulsa Remote,
wow. What an interesting strategy.
Yes. I wrote the book. I'm like, whoever thought of Tulsa Remote, because you know, it came down to like, it's the government that gets credit for the, you know, the city of Tulsa, but you know, it was one individual that probably had that idea. And I'm like, I hope that person got a huge raise and gets all the credit for this because like, not only did they do that, but then you started to see all these copycats during COVID. And now Airbnb is working directly with Tulsa Remote and some of these other programs. So
just real quick on that Tulsa Remote thing, what do you think is the impact on Tulsa of attracting these high earning tech? Is it like they trying to become a tech hub by attracting more tech employees?
Yeah, I think that they feel like people that work in tech make more money and that they'll spend money. And so they were just trying to attract high salary, high skilled people there and thinking that the city would benefit from that. And then I think a secondary benefit of that has just been that they've gotten a lot of press and they've looked very cool that they've had this thought. And so again, bravo to the person that did that.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Okay. So, you know, you're telling us about remote work and Airbnb, people trying out cities, which is, you know, I think one thing that's kind of cool about that too, is that if you do own a home somewhere, then you can also allow other people to try out your city while you're trying out other cities. I mean, depending on your living situation and whatnot, but not something that, you know, it's, I mean, it's like this whole home sharing. That was how the economy, you know, Airbnb kind of got started, was with VRBO and home sharing and house swapping. So anyways, I think that's a cool opportunity for people.
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-C-A-P.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
I totally agree. I think people having a lot more options these days, and then rethinking all the things that we've always thought, like, this is the only way you do it, and you only stay at hotels, and you only vacation, you know, 2 weeks of the year and stuff. I think it's very exciting that people have these different options. And I think, actually, to my point earlier about people getting tired of doing Airbnb because it's a lot of work sometimes, something that happens too is that they've done it for 2 or 3 years and they don't know what to do with the furniture. And so moving into these 30 plus day furnished rentals is a great way to go, because there's not a very good return on investment with the furniture. So whatever you buy, like, that's, you're never going to recoup that money. So if you can move it into these 30 plus day furnished rentals, you make more than a traditional rental, you make less than Airbnb, but it's a lot less work. And so that's really attractive. And I think a lot of the book is just about how to set those rentals up, how to find those people, because before Airbnb published this, there was something called Furnish Finder, where people were going through Facebook Marketplace. And also what the 30 plus day renter cares about is a little bit different than what your short-term renter would care about. So just talking about the different ins and outs with that.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. So I want to hear about your why, for why you're still, like, you know, I think the reason that we're all in this business is important. And I'm curious to hear, you know, what really juices you and inspires you to keep going.
I think it's probably two parts for me, kind of like early adopters and entrepreneurial thought is really interesting to me. And I like those kind of people, I gravitate toward them. So that's one side of it. And then the second is trying to address inequity, or trying to make real estate more accessible to other people. That is very important to me, because I just think as long as we have these systems in place where it only seems like certain kinds of people can do certain types of things, I hate that. I have a lot, like, I just want to see that change. And I relate to that on the female side, because that's where I see it. I know it's definitely true in the people of color side. It's just hard, you know, that's not my experience, but I can relate to it through feeling like there's been some discrimination against females, both from the outside, but also how they see themselves as well, how they don't feel comfortable sometimes in this world. So I think on the entrepreneurial side, the why is just that it's fascinating to me. And I feel like the more that we have options, the better your life can be. And I don't like the fact, or not that I don't like the fact, that I think that it's a huge opportunity, that it's no longer just a 9-to-5 and the only space and the only success you have is if you ascribe to, like, the way things always were. I think that that cuts out a lot of people that have very interesting ideas and a lot to offer. So it excites me if there are opportunities through Airbnb or real estate or passive investing where they just have options, or that their thoughts and stuff are valued in a way that they weren't before. So that's the entrepreneurial side. And then again, the access side, it makes me sad to only see, like, I meet a lot of young people that are new to investing, and 25-year-old white men, you don't need to talk them into it. They're very confident. They're overly confident. They met a relative that looked like them once at Thanksgiving, and they're like, they did it, I can do it. But for the females, sometimes it's like trying to convince them. Like, in grad school, I wrote a paper about how women were marketed to differently. And one thing that came up is that women make 85% of the housing decisions, but they're only 25% of investors. And it's a very similar situation. So I found that frustrating, and I wanted to see more women in investing.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, as you know, that's a topic that I'm super passionate about, is increasing access
to investing and wealth building and closing that investment gap, which, you know, exists across a couple different demographics, women and people of color being two of them. So yeah, I'm curious to hear, you know, what has come up in your conversations with, I mean, and you've spoken to a little bit about, like, what do you think can be done to sort of move the needle on that?
I think having more conversations like this, honestly, and then more groups that maybe are targeted at females, that can be tricky because sometimes people don't like to think of themselves as different or they don't want a specific group for them. But the way that women versus men learn is different. So I think that that should be acknowledged. And I think when you don't acknowledge it, it's saying that's bad. And it's not bad. It's just a different thing. And what I mean by that as an example is, again, you know, men, they meet an older relative, they do it, they feel confident, they feel good about it. The females tend to need to have multiple resources telling them that this makes sense, or multiple access points. So a friend that's done it, a book that they've read, a podcast that they've heard. So I think maybe having more interviews with females that have done it so that they see themselves for that, targeting more stuff, but being realistic in the targeting. I think in the past, a lot of times, and I think we still see this a little bit, but when it's female targeted, I think in the past, they made it pink. It was like, oh, we'll make it pink and you'll feel like it's for you. And I feel like now sometimes what they do is they like put like a stamp on it, like you're brave if you're a female investor. And I think some of that stuff comes across as really trite and insincere, and it turns people off. And so not having marketing like that, but marketing really talking about, this is how your situation might be different. These are the goals or the concerns that you might have, and addressing it on that end.
Yeah, for sure. I think that, you know, that makes a lot of sense. And also people are going to respond differently to different types of, you know, inspiration marketing. So, but just having more women in the space, it is starting to change, I hope. And women are getting more, I think it's going to happen. The wave is going to, but yeah, it's going to take a village to make sure that close that investing gap. And that's kind of one of my mottos, is closing the investing gap one investor at a time. So yeah. So I would also love to hear, Erin, about like what other, like where you think you guys are headed with your business, and like if you're going to continue to do Airbnb, what you see the future of that is. And also just touching on like maybe the last year and how COVID impacted yours and your clients' business.
Yeah, great questions. I think when it first happened, I was really nervous, you know, like I don't know if we're going to sell another house for 6 months, because we just didn't know how things were going to go. And then it ended up being one of the best real estate years we'd had up until that point, but a strong year for everyone. And I had really mixed feelings.
Even as far as buying and selling properties.
Yes, exactly. And investors, I think investors were scooping stuff up, and I have mixed feelings about that, because I think I obviously am so thankful that we didn't have the financial stress during that time, but a lot of people around you were. So it was just hard to see, you know, the K economy. Some people are doing awesome and some people are having such a hard time. And I feel like sometimes with investors, there's a lot of privilege. And so just trying to speak to people about that, like, and how to talk to your tenants, be kind to your tenants during a hard time. Like, yeah, it's not only the right thing to do, but it's in your best interest to retain your existing tenants. So just talking about things like that, that was one side of it with COVID. I think for us personally, you know, we're going into our fifth year. And I think there's always been a question about having a team underneath us. And I think this is a big question for entrepreneurs in general, is growth. And what does that look like? And can you retain the quality if you grow? And I think at this point, we've decided we will probably just keep it the two of us, because we feel like we are quite comfortable in this. And sometimes having employees is much harder than being a real estate agent. So I think that has been a question that we've been thinking about for the last year. And I think it's something that we're going to stay small and see what that looks like, and then maybe pursue things within that. But I think one concentration will be not growing, like resisting that urge.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I can relate to that so much. It's like, well, when is enough enough? You know, I mean, is an ambitious person. And, you know, I'm also like you, attracted to the entrepreneurial types of people and attracted to growth and contribution and all of that. And so it's hard to know when to stop, you know, for me personally. And so I'm glad that you're paying attention to that. And, you know, it's a tricky balance to find. And yeah, I wish you the best with that. Yeah. So, you know, we talked about this a little bit before the show, and curious to get your thoughts on kids and how, you know, either women with kids or people with children, like maybe are going to approach real estate investing differently than those who don't have kids or other life factors.
Yeah, no, it was a great conversation ahead of time because I think that it's so relevant as females and relevant too, I think, as males, but we think about it more with females. But the reason why I try to be aware of it sometimes is just that I think in bigger pockets or some of the entrepreneurial circles, you see people that quit their jobs. And that's what we did. We quit our jobs within a month of each other. My husband was a little bit more planned. Honestly, I got mad at my boss and I was like, I'm out of here. Like, forget it, you know? And so I think sometimes people hear that and they think it's so cool. And I'm like, it is. I'm very glad I did it. But I want to be realistic and aware of the fact that we don't have kids and we don't have a family. And my parents would always support us, you know, not like they weren't supporting us, but we were never going to be homeless. So if the sky fell, there would always be food for us to eat. There'd always be somewhere for us to live. And so I want to be like mindful of that. And I think when you have kids, your choices are different. And I don't have that experience, so I can't speak for anyone else. I don't want anyone to like take umbrage with the fact of like, oh, we can still do it. I'm not saying that. I just also want to say like my risk factor was different. And I think that's true for people. I also think, as we were talking about before the episode started, like you are starting to see a lot more people choose not to have kids. So we'll see how that expands over time and what that looks like and how those communities are built out. And then the opportunities, the ways, it'll be interesting to see if we're targeted as a group in the future, because you tend to have more income and more flexibility if you don't have children.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I mean, I think it even just speak like what you were saying about risk, right? It can feel harder and, you know, there's more at stake when, you know, you have your family at stake, and that can be either a driving force for people or it can be a hindrance in getting started with real estate. And I've, you know, I'm sure it goes both ways. I've talked to people, but I think one, you know, just to your point, one thing to, you know, that I want to impress upon our audience is get started early. You know, I mean, if you can get started before you have those extra responsibilities with investing, with, you know, building a financial nest egg, with building more and more passive streaming, I mean, especially for, you know, the women and minority groups out there, it's so important to do that. You know, if you can, I mean, not to say you can't do it at any point in your life, but if you can get started and you're listening to this, then try to start early, you know?
I think that that is amazing advice. I think everybody that's listening to you right now should be thanking you, because I think just like they say with the stock market, but maybe they don't talk about it as much with the real estate, but it's like get in early because, you know, you're just going to have so many advantages. Your risk profile, again, when you're younger is a little bit different. You can sustain those hits. But also, if you learn that buying a house and renting it out to tenants when you're 18 is not that scary, you have a whole lifetime to do that and you're going to be so rich. So I just am like, do it when you're young. It's, I mean, we started when I was 35 and I feel thankful for that. But it's just like, I met someone the other day who was in high school and his dad had brought him to an investing meeting. And he was saying, my goal is to have my first one by the time I'm 21. And I thought, it's just so cool that your dad is sharing that with you and that, you know, this is a hobby you guys have together, but it's also really going to help you. I think not just with money, but also how you see, you know, being a business owner and taking on things. And so it's great.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Erin, it's been so great talking to you, and I'm so happy that you came on the show and shared your journey and all this great information and resources for us. Excited to see your book come out. Why don't you let the listeners know, you know, anything else you want to say and a way to get in touch with you?
Well, sure. So you can find us at erinandjamesrealestate.com, and that's Erin, E-R-I-N, like the woman's spelling, not like the man's. The and is spelled out. So A-N-D, erinandjamesrealestate.com. And then the book is called American Nomads, and it is on Amazon. And it's also available in audio form as well, and should be on Audible by the time this launches. So
totally.
Thank you so much. This was a great talk. It's always nice when you meet someone and you can just like hit all these topics right off the bat. And like, it's not awkward, you know, like it's great when you have a good conversation immediately when you meet someone.
Yeah, so, definitely. Thank you. Definitely feel the same way. Thank you so much, Erin. And yeah, until next time, we'll see you later.
Have a good one. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.